Hello and welcome back to Current State. I'm Scott Pohl filling in for Mark Bayshore, who's away. Good to have you with us on the program today. We've got a lot ahead on the show. I hope you'll stick around for the entire hour. We're going to talk basketball with Al Martin. We'll hear from State Representative Tom Barrett on the new Michigan Veterans Institute that he's helping to form. And also a conversation about a new documentary about farts, believe it or not. Can't wait for that segment. We're going to start things off, though, with a look at the politics going on in Michigan right now as Michigan prepares to hold its presidential primary tomorrow. We're taking a look at last night's Democratic debate in Flint, and we'll also review what happened at the Republicans' debate last Thursday in Detroit. Joining us to discuss the debates and looking ahead to tomorrow's primary, the Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta. Hi, Rick.
Good morning, Scott.
Good to have you on the show. Nancy Kaffer is also with us. Nancy is with the Detroit Free Press. Good morning, Nancy.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here, too. Let's start, Nancy, with a look at last night's debate in Flint between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, which you attended. I know that they spent a lot of time talking about the Flint water crisis. Give us a sense, for people who didn't see the debate, give us a sense for how much time they spent talking about Flint and what the content of that conversation was.
They spent much more time talking about Flint than I had imagined that they would. And, you know, as Bernie Sanders has called before for Governor Snyder to step down over this, over the handling of the Flint water crisis, last night Secretary Clinton also added her call for Governor Snyder to step down and supported the recall efforts that are underway in the state to remove him from office. You know, a lot of it talked about, you know, how to help kids, the importance of helping kids, the tragedy that's happened to kids. But, you know, a few specifics, which is not really surprising when you're talking about national figures who have sort of the 30,000-foot view of what's happening in a very local situation. So it was interesting. It was very nice to see residents of Flint brought up to ask questions of these folks. That's not an opportunity that your average resident of any town in the country typically gets to question a presidential candidate. And it was really nice to see Flint residents integrated as a real part of the debate and not you know, trotted out for a photo op and then taken back into the audience.
It talked over almost, you know, talking over them, like talking over their heads to the candidates, letting them join the conversation is all I meant by that. As you mentioned, Sanders had already called on Governor Snyder to resign, but Hillary Clinton last night agreed, and for the first time, she also called for Governor Snyder to resign. Let's hear some of that audio.
His dereliction of duty was irresponsible. He should resign.
I agree. The governor should resign or be recalled, and we should...
Rick Pluta, was that expected? Were we expecting Hillary Clinton to join the call for Governor Snyder to step down?
No, in fact, previously she had said that you know, that sort of rhetoric was just you know, political and not realistic. So it's interesting that she joined the call. But you know, I don't know that you can go to Flint these days and try to defend Rick Snyder.
For Democratic voters, do you think it matters who went first, so to speak, in calling on Governor Snyder to step down? Either of you?
I think for Flint voters, it might.
Yeah, you know, I think there's probably a small percentage of voters to whom that kind of thing is really significant. Probably folks who really, maybe folks who really are already committed to a candidate want to use it as a way to show that their candidate is better because they were on the issue first. But I think for a lot of people, that distinction is not, and for a general audience, that distinction is maybe not as sharp as the folks who would like to promote one line over the other would like it to be.
And I think the more time that goes by, the less significant it becomes who went first.
Right. And, you know, tomorrow it's only a day or two. That's part of why I asked the question. Sanders and Clinton also clashed over the auto bailout. We have some audio of that, too. We're going to hear first from Hillary Clinton.
I voted to save the auto industry. He voted against the money that ended up saving the auto industry.
And here's Bernie Sanders.
Secretary Clinton supported virtually every one of these disastrous trade agreements written by corporate America.
Nancy Kaffer, can you shed some light maybe on what the root of the argument is here over the auto bailout?
Well, you know, I mean, it's pretty simple. Yes, simple. We're going to talk about TARP, and it's going to be simple. After the 2008 crash, I mean, there was a bailout package that included money to help the auto industry and money that would help the big banks. Sanders was opposed. Clinton supported that. I mean, that's really there's a lot more. I'm really simplifying the whole thing here, but I mean that's basically what happened there. I was surprised. If I were Bernie Sanders, I would have wanted to move on from that conversation as quickly as possible, because while he has been consistent in his opposition to bank bailouts and his interest in breaking up the big banks, et cetera, this is something that's really hits home for people in Michigan. The financial crisis and the near collapse of the auto industry was really recent, and it's a really fresh memory, I think, for a lot of people here. And that I'm not sure how well it flies to oppose the bailout on principle because of the banks, when this is a matter for a lot of people of losing their livelihood. Once again, I thought that if I were Senator Sanders, I would have wanted to leave that topic behind as quickly as possible. And obviously, Secretary Clinton.
Go ahead, Nancy.
Yeah, you would think the. I'm sorry.
No, you. Go, Rick.
Rick, go ahead.
I was just going to say that the distinction was both rhetorical and about priorities. That Senator Clinton was saying she voted for the bail for the auto rescue, and Bernie Sanders said he voted against the Wall Street bailout, and it almost became just the two of them repeating that line over and over and over again. Clearly, it was more important for Bernie Sanders to vote against the Wall Street bailout, and it was more important for Secretary Clinton to vote for the auto rescue.
Well, you know, a lot of people.
It's actually a pretty good summation of the sort of nature of the candidates. People love Bernie Sanders because he's an idealist, and the people who love Hillary Clinton love her because she's a pragmatist. And I thought that was a really nice encapsulation of the way that they approach an issue.
The auto bailout was a big thing that hurt Mitt Romney in Michigan 4 years ago, though, didn't it?
Sure.
Absolutely. But it. Your turn, Nancy.
He wrote that op-ed in the New York Times with the headline "Let Detroit Go Bankrupt," "Let Detroit Go Broke," or "Let Detroit Go Bankrupt." Anyway, it was the headline was not as inflammatory as the piece was, and sort of what he wrote was a lot of what wound up happening. But it really turned voters off. Nobody likes to be told. I mean, I remember very clearly, even as a reporter covering this stuff, just how stressful it was and how concerning it was and how scary it was. And I think probably everyone, that's still a pretty recent feeling for all of us here who were so, whose lives are so entwined with the auto industry's economic presence in the state.
Rick, what kind of surprises did you see last night? Anything really surprise you last night, Rick?
I don't think there were any big surprises last night that the candidates behaved true to form. One of the things that was interesting, I thought, was the whole debate over the Wall Street bailout versus the automotive rescue. And I thought it was very interesting how much time they spent on Flint urban policy, things that really matter to the city where the debate was located, where the Republican debate was a lot different. It was largely a Trump takedown. Just 7.5 minutes of that debate was spent on actual Michigan, Detroit, Flint kinds of things.
Yeah, when Detroit and other places, it was Flint, that kind of thing came up in the Republican debate, it was like failure of liberal government, next.
Right.
There was not a lot of real discussion. I personally was surprised in last night's debate. Did it not seem to you like they just spent a god-awful long time talking about the Export-Import Bank, which I'm pretty sure was probably the first time that most of America learned that we had an Export-Import Bank? It's something that I'm pretty wonky, and I have a hard time kind of keeping my eyelids propped open to discussions of the XM Bank. That just seemed like an interminable period of time. Maybe y'all felt differently about the XM Bank, but that was surprising to me. If you'd asked me, what do you think are the most likely things to have come up in a presidential debate, that would have been like maybe 500th on my list.
Although it is a critical difference between the two of them.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. A critical difference that five people care about.
maybe more people should.
Well, I think a lot more people care about that, but you know, five people know about. I mean, it's a fair point.
Yes,
it's just one of the things that separates them.
We're talking with Nancy Kaffer of the Detroit Free Press and Rick Pluta of the Michigan Public Radio Network about presidential politics in Michigan, with the presidential primary in the state coming up tomorrow. Nancy, the Flint water crisis also came up at the Republican debate last week. Let's talk a little bit about how the Republicans are doing on getting the details of the crisis right compared to the Democrats last night. Do you have a sense for that?
Yeah, I mean, the Republican debate, there were a lot of the responses when they were asked about DPS or Flint or Detroit Public Schools or Flint or Detroit, really, I thought there could have been a little more studying up. I felt like Democrats had a better grasp on the facts. Though, when the city of Detroit came up, Bernie Sanders' campaign has recently put out this a couple of tweets that attempt to link Detroit's financial problems to NAFTA, which is a real weird misfire. Showing, you know, there's a tweet he's put out that has pictures of four blighted buildings and saying, you know, people of Detroit understand the impact of Hillary Clinton's trade policies. You know, I mean, obviously anyone who studied Detroit's history is aware that Detroit's decline began in the 60s, which is well before NAFTA, in the early 90s, and then got worse with the auto industry downturn in the early 80s, once again well before NAFTA. And a lot of the houses, you know, buildings pictured in this tweet, I'm told a couple have been demolished, one has been rehabbed. It's a real strange. I mean, you can talk about the impact of NAFTA on manufacturing in general, but to link it directly to what happened to Detroit is not. I've yet to talk to anyone who thinks that's a legitimate cause and effect.
We want to hear a little audio from
back around in the general election campaign.
I'm sorry, Rick. Go ahead. What was that?
I was going to say, look for that one to come back around in the general election campaign, when it's most likely going to be, you know, Hillary versus you know, whoever the Republican is, and that can be resurrected and shown. This is what, you know, what Hillary does to what Hillary's economic policies do to cities, according to Bernie Sanders.
We do want to hear a little audio from the Republican debate last week in Detroit. First of all, they did touch on some Michigan issues. Here's Ted Cruz on Detroit.
Detroit is a great city with a magnificent legacy that has been utterly decimated by 60 years of failed left-wing policies.
Also, John Kasich spoke about some suggestions he has for the schools in Detroit.
Fixing schools rests at the state and the local level, and particularly at the school board level. Now, I also believe that you need to introduce vocational education in those schools.
And also, when it came to Governor Snyder, Marco Rubio had some comments.
I don't think that someone woke up one morning and said, let's figure out how to poison the water system to hurt someone. But accountability is important. I will say I give the governor credit. He took responsibility for what happened. And he's talked about people being held accountable and the need to change this, Governor Snyder.
Rick Pluta, tell us your response, or your sense of the crowd response to those messages last week.
Well, you could hear it, but, you know, the core Republican establishment, you know, believes that Rick Snyder is sort of being hung out to dry on this, that he's being blamed for a lot of things that were not strictly state problems. And so, you know, Marco Rubio wasn't losing points with this particular crowd or the Republican base by saying that. Now, of course, a lot of other people, you know, think differently about it, including all those Democrats in Flint who cheered when Sanders and Clinton called for Snyder to quit or be recalled.
Nancy Kaffer of the Detroit Free Press, did Trump talk about these Michigan issues much last week at the debate?
No, I thought it was interesting when they went to ask questions. You know, the question about Detroit public schools was addressed specifically to Kasich, which I thought was interesting that these questions were framed kind of away from the front runner. Kasich, of course, led off with some wrong answers. He said that he believed the mayor was now in charge of Detroit schools, which isn't true. And then he mentioned that important pieces to help Detroit schools were charter schools and school choice vouchers. Well, we have a lot of charter schools, and actually these sort of proliferation of charter schools and some real accountability questions have not been helping the Detroit school situation. And school vouchers are obviously not constitutional in Michigan. So that was, once again, why, you know, some sort of misfires about what was going on there. What I think is interesting about what Ted Cruz was talking about, you know, quote-unquote 60 years of failed liberal policies, in a campaign where there's been an awful lot of racially tinged rhetoric or outright, you know, racially focused rhetoric from some candidates on the Republican side, candidates need to be very careful about the fact that 60 years of liberal policies also dovetails with the rise of African-American elected political leaders in the city of Detroit. And I think people, GOP candidates seem to be really careful how they kind of paint those years and whether or not they're painting into a narrative that has some real alienating aspects for minority voters.
I want to get in one last real quick question, just a minute or so, you two. The recent polls from CBS and 538 are predicting Trump and Clinton victories in Michigan yesterday. Do either of you think that anything that's been said in these debates in Flint last night and in Detroit last week will have an impact on those results? Are those the results you're expecting tomorrow? Nancy?
Yeah, we had a Free Press. The Free Press did a poll. We found that Hillary Clinton had a sizable lead over Sanders, I think 25 points. I think Hillary Clinton she's got a good organization here in Michigan. I don't think anything, there was no big game changer from the debate. Our poll found that Trump was only leading by 10 points here, which is surprising considering how poll results are coming out in other places. And once again, I think he fared about the same as he does in every debate, which is he's loud and blustery and doesn't have much to say in the way of real substance. But people seem to love that. So I don't expect anything that happened there to be a game changer either.
Is that your sense too, Rick Pluta?
By and large, although I wonder that you know, the Detroit Fox News debate, you know, was largely sort of a truth squad effort on Donald Trump. And I wonder if that won't, chip away maybe at a little bit of his support. But I don't think that it would have any substantial, substantial change.
We've been talking with the Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta and Nancy Kaffer of the Detroit Free Press about the Democratic debate in Flint last night, as well as last Thursday's Republican debate in Detroit, ahead of tomorrow's presidential primary in Michigan. Rick, Nancy, thank you both for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much.
Oh, pleasure.
And coming up on Current State, Republican State Representative Tom Barrett and Democratic State Senator David Kinesic are working together to form the Michigan Veterans Institute. The nonprofit will work to help vets get services they need. I have a conversation with Representative Barrett about the project coming up. Cutting the cheese, breaking wind, passing gas. No matter the euphemism, it's pretty hard not to laugh when you're talking about flatulence. Whether you're 5 or 50, nothing is quite as funny as a good fart joke. But how about a fart documentary? Yes, that's right. Everything you ever wanted to know about flatulence can be found in Fart, a documentary. Troy Hale is the director of this funky film. He's also a professor of practice in the College of Communication Arts and Sciences here at MSU, and he joins us now. Welcome to Current State, Troy.
Thank you very much.
Good to see you. I have to confess, in a lengthy career in radio, this is either going to be the defining moment of my career, this conversation, or the final moment of my career.
Oh, boy. I hope it's a defining moment then.
All right. Well, the first question has to be, what motivated you to make a movie about farts?
Oh, people ask me that a bunch of times.
It's required.
Well, it's one of those things that you talk about with close friends and family, and I think what happened was I got into a conversation with some close friends and family, and we just laughed really hard about it for about an hour, and I said, well, you know what? Maybe this should be a film. And of course this has been made, right? It had to have been made. And I did some research and nope, couldn't find anything. So I said, well, when I find a topic that it hasn't been done, I said, that's a good film to make.
Well, it has to be a conversation with close friends or family because mm-hmm. it doesn't come up at the cocktail party.
Well, you know, it's funny, now that I'm doing
the Brie and cheese, you know, Brie and crackers.
Now that I'm doing the film, it actually does come up. And
well, it sort of has to when you wear a t-shirt
you're
wearing right now.
Exactly. I got to have some advertising, right? No, it now it comes up and we start talking about it and we just, you know, have a really fun time. You know, I was in the green room back there and we heard your tease and I heard somebody in the control room say he tried to say that without laughing, you know.
Right,
so
it's
a great topic.
Well, here I am laughing during the conversation with you. That will happen more than once, I'm sure.
Great.
All right, so this isn't just a movie of fart jokes, though. There are a few of those in the movie, but I'd like you to explore a little bit more about what's in the documentary that you've just made.
Well, you know, it is about the humor of it. It's about, it's one of those topics that culturally throughout the world is funny everywhere. And there's very few things that I think we can think that everywhere in the world is funny. And so we dive into that a little bit. We dive into why we don't talk about it. You know, it's an embarrassing topic, and you know, we get embarrassed about it, but everybody finds it funny when it happens. And, you know, you can...
I was hoping you brought the whoopee cushion
here,
in
you like
with
it?
You today. Absolutely, I have to have that.
I have a couple of them here.
All right. Now, did you get any kind of answer as to why farts are such a reliable laugh-getter? Do you have a sense for that?
A couple of things. I mean, one thing, you know, what we just had there, the sound of it. It's just a funny sound. And there was an audio technician in England that did something about the sound and why the sound was so funny. But also, it's something we try to, you know, hold in. It's something that we, you know, if it happens to us, it's embarrassing, which makes other people laugh because they're glad it didn't happen to them.
Well, I must say, you're 5 or 6 feet away from me. That's probably a good thing during this conversation.
Well, especially since the average person farts 14 times a day. So in this studio, you've probably had it happen a number of times.
Well, and I know people for whom that number is almost certainly low. That must be an average.
It is an average.
I know some above average people.
Yeah.
One of the people you interview in the film has a pretty unique profession. We want to hear a little bit of audio about this. Let's take a listen to Mr. Methane's appearance on Britain's Got Talent.
Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to put the art into fart. First of all, I just have to adopt the farting position. Okay. You pick...
Who's that?
That was a good one.
Music Master! Thank you.
All right, Troy Hale, you have to tell us more about Mr. Methane. How far did he get on Britain's Got Talent?
He's a talented guy, isn't he?
That's a skill. That is a skill.
Actually, you know, I don't think he got very far. I think he got buzzed off, but and he kind of disgusted Simon Cowell. But Simon had actually seen him before, so he actually knew about this guy. But,
well, he must have approved him being on the show. He's a big part.
Yeah,
of Britain's
I think he was kind of a plant to put on the show. But it was a really funny moment, and it's up on YouTube. It's right. A really funny thing to watch.
Did you approach this subject from a medical perspective at all?
I did talk to some doctors about it. And, you know, we got some of the stats. You know, the average person farts 14 times a day. Mm-hmm. The average fart is 7 miles an hour. So it's you know, some as he looks into the control room. So there are some very interesting medical things about it. And, you know, it's good for you to fart. It's not good to hold it in, all those kind of things. So, yeah we talked to a doctor about it.
So there are doctors who actually study this or even specialize in
this? I think there's a whole field in fartology? No, something like that, yeah.
Sounds right.
Yeah.
Troy Hale is a documentary filmmaker and a professor of practice in the College of Communication Arts and Sciences here at MSU. We're talking about his latest film. It's entitled Fart, a Documentary. Now, Troy, one of the interesting things you explore in your new movie is the history of farts, and you talk to a man named Jim Dawson. Tell us what you learned from Jim Dawson.
Jim Dawson has actually written a trilogy of fart books, which I found very funny. And
One book didn't cover
one
it?
One book wasn't
Two
enough.
Two books wasn't
yeah,
enough?
You'll be amazed how much this stuff sells.
That does not surprise me.
So, yeah, he wrote a trilogy of fart books, and you know, during my research, I looked up a lot of stuff, and I found his book and went through it pretty extensively. There's a lot of history to fart. There's a scroll from Japan from the 1400s, and it's basically a political cartoon based on the Europeans coming over to Japan and what the Japanese thought about the Europeans coming over to Japan, and it's a bunch of picture, you know, drawings of Japanese people farting on Europeans. There's the first whoopee cushion was supposed to supposedly in ancient Rome or something like that. You know, one of the emperors, you know, that had a good sense of humor. I heard that George W. Bush had a pretty good sense of humor in board meetings.
One assumes you did not put a whoopee cushion under Nero's seat, though.
Probably not.
Probably or Caesar.
Or maybe that did happen.
Maybe that's why he burned it down. Do you have a favorite historical fact?
Oh, geez. I don't, the scrolls are pretty funny when you look at them and you realize how old they are, and somebody way back then thought it was funny and decided to make this massive piece of artwork on it.
When you were doing the research for this movie, did you come across any facts that you found to be particularly surprising? Anything you didn't expect to encounter?
Let's see. I mean, the 14 times a day was really interesting. Every time I bring that up, and when I bring up the 7 miles an hour, everybody kind of laughs about that. So those were two good stats. There were a number of infographics that I found that are very easily searched on the internet, and it was really interesting to just go through all that stuff, and somebody took the time to really scientifically go through that.
How do you measure the velocity of a fart?
Everybody asks me that. I have no idea.
One of those wind gauge
Yeah,
things,
one
I
of those
guess.
Hurricane wind gauges is probably the way, yeah.
All right. Now, you managed to collect some funny fart-related memorabilia, and you've brought some of it into the
Sure,
studio.
yeah.
Can you
yeah.
tell me a little bit about what you
Let's
have
see.
here?
Well, here you go. You'll like this one first. You can talk about that
All
one.
right. This is a pair of tighty whities, and the slogan printed on the back of them. I can't see it. You
Oh, sorry.
It.
I'm sorry. I'm
World's
showing you.
Largest source of natural gas.
Yeah. So there's a lot of those kind of things around. I found that at a store somewhere.
Yeah.
I have this this little outhouse guy. Let's see if we can.
Old MacDonald had a E-I-E-I with a beer in a.
And it goes on and on.
Yeah, apparently.
And one of my friends grabbed me this fart piano.
Oh my
and,
gosh.
Yeah. And you could play music on it, which is interesting. And she said she was going through the store and
That's great.
It actually leaned up against something and she was getting pretty embarrassed.
One real last, well,
sure.
real quick last question. How do people see your movie or own it?
It's on Amazon.com. There's the DVDs there. It is also, I've got a little card here. Let me see. Amazon, Google Play, iTunes, Vimeo On Demand, and Vudu right now. And hopefully in the future, it'll be on television.
All right. It sounds like a PBS fundraiser special.
Sure.
Okay. We'll have to talk with our friends at WKAR TV.
Sounds good.
We've been talking about Fart, a documentary, with director Troy Hale, who's also a professor of practice in the College of Communication Arts and Sciences at MSU. Troy, thanks for bringing us a few laughs on the show today.
No problem. Thanks
Good
for having me
here. Coming up on Current State, the MSU men's basketball team wrapped up the regular season this weekend with a win over Ohio State. The MSU women made it to the finals of the Big Ten tournament before falling to Maryland. We'll talk with current sports host Al Martin about Spartan basketball. That and more after the break on Current State. And welcome back to Current State. Good to have you with us today. I'm Scott Pohl, filling in for Mark Bayshore, who is away. A new effort to boost the lives of veterans in Michigan has been announced by a state House Republican and a state Senate Democrat. The recent announcement of formation of the Michigan Veterans Institute came close on the heels of a scathing state audit of the Grand Rapids Home for Veterans. The audit found the private company operating the facility has a poor record when it comes to performing basic but crucial tasks like bed checks and responding to emergency calls. I spoke late last week with one of the lawmakers forming the Michigan Veterans Institute, Potterville Republican Representative Tom Barrett. He says this project, with Senate Democrat David Kinesic, was already in the works when the news from Grand Rapids broke. Representative Tom Barrett, welcome to Current State.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Now, I understand that you and Senator Kinesic were working on the formation of the Michigan Veterans Institute even before the recent news about the state audit of the Grand Rapids Home for Veterans came out. I want to ask you about your motivation if it wasn't something like the problems that were found at the Grand Rapids Home, like failure to make bed checks and respond to allegations of abuse and neglect. What was behind this idea?
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up because the findings in that audit are just absolutely unacceptable, and I was really heartbroken and outraged to hear about them, and I've made a commitment, and I know David has as well, and many of my other colleagues in the legislature have made statements of our willingness to make sure that this is corrected and fixed. But our motivation for the Michigan Veterans Institute did precede that. Both Senator Kinesic and I came to the legislature intent on doing our best to do what we can to help veterans. And David and I are the only two Iraq War veterans serving in the Michigan legislature, so that kind of gives us a unique position to advocate from with many of our colleagues here that we serve with. So in 2015, we worked together on a bipartisan package of bills to extend protections to veterans who have post-traumatic stress or a traumatic brain injury or another service-related disability, and they, if they have the use of a service dog, that we wanted to protect them when they go in public. So we joined together in a bipartisan way to work with our colleagues on both sides of the aisle to pass legislation that protects veterans with these special needs to allow them to have service dogs in public for those invisible wounds that are not necessarily displaying a physical symptom. And kind of our Michigan Veterans Institute idea stemmed out of that because we thought about raising some funds for veterans who needed a service dog but could not obtain one because the waiting list is so long and there's a shortage of available trainers. So it started out with that in mind, and then it's grown from there to be more of a holistic view of what we can do for our veterans, not just on the service dog front, but on their total reintegration needs beyond that.
Why form a nonprofit as opposed to drafting legislation together?
Well, you know, we've done legislation together, and certainly where that's appropriate, we will continue to do so. That's our job as legislators, is to, you know, draft legislation that puts our veterans in the best position possible. But it's not always legislation to do that, as it relates specifically to service dogs, for example. You know, a lot of those are donated by trainers who see this need, and as a you know, side from their normal training that they do as a profitable company, they do one or two service dogs that they'll train for veterans on the side and help them out. What we want to do is increase the capacity for that by providing grants to organizations that will train service dogs for veterans and reduce that waiting period. We also want to look at reducing homelessness. Unfortunately, we can't wave a magic wand that just you know, eliminates homelessness in our country, so it's going to take a diligent, disciplined effort to do that. We want to raise resources to help in that regard. We want to connect veterans with job opportunities. 2014, we had the second highest veteran unemployment rate in the entire country. We want to do what we can to help veterans find jobs and transition into successful careers when they come back home, improving options for health care, and then setting up local mentoring initiatives so that veterans who do find a job or do transition back home into a civilian capacity don't lose that someday because they're struggling to fully reintegrate. We want to assign them mentors that can help them with that transition in that medium-term time period that it might take to get them fully comfortable and reintegrated all the way. That's not, you know, stuff that might require legislative efforts, but it's more things that need to be done from an advocacy and charitable fundraising point of view.
What will the leadership structure be like?
Well, David and I are going to be, of course, leading this effort, but we're putting together a list of folks who are going to serve on our board. We're trying to reach out to other veterans that we know. AT&T has been very generous in helping us kickstart this entire effort, and Jim Kirsch, who's a government liaison with AT&T, is going to be serving on our board. He's a Navy veteran of 6 years himself, so we've welcomed him on board too. And then there are going to be others that we're going to be reaching out to as well. Some, you know, perhaps former legislative leaders who are veterans and others that we want to reach out to say, hey, would you be willing to serve on a steering committee for us so that we can make the best decisions possible? In addition, I should say that we are intent on going out and listening to veterans in town hall meetings around the state, because we may have an idea of what the needs of the veteran community are based on our own experiences and those of our friends that we've served with together, but we may miss something. So we want to go out and listen to veterans that have come home and are reintegrating right now or have struggled with something in the past and listen to what their needs are to move forward with as well, so that we don't inadvertently miss something.
Representative Barrett, you are a 15-year service member in the Army, currently a Chief Warrant Officer 2 in the Michigan Army National Guard. You have served in South Korea, Guantanamo Bay, Kuwait, and Iraq. Senator Kinesic served in the Marines in Iraq. How important is it that veterans like yourselves and other lawmakers and others who are behind the Michigan Veterans Institute are veterans, men and women who have served their country? How important is that?
Well, you know, I wish we had more, frankly, you know, at the same time, we've seen a overall decline in the number of people serving in the military in our population. So as a percent of our population members of the military have declined, and we're about 1% of the population now of the country. So with that being the case, there are fewer veterans going into positions in politics and in leadership positions in government and other things like that. So you've seen a diminishing number over time. Certainly when we fought wars like in World War II, where most people were drafted or served in the military in some capacity or another, you know, we had a lot of folks, there was a lot of density of population of folks who were veterans, but that just isn't the case today. We'd certainly love to see more veterans, but, you know, I will point out that you don't have to be a veteran to care about veterans' issues, and we have many people who aren't veterans themselves who really have taken on roles to care about veterans, and I want to be respectful of that, too. I don't think you have to be a veteran to care about veterans' issues, but certainly I think it gives you a special sense of purpose when you are a veteran to pay it forward for your friends and your, you know, battle buddies that you've served with to try and help them out in the best way possible.
How important is it that this is a bipartisan effort?
Well, sure, and it is important that it's a bipartisan effort, but it's really a nonpartisan effort. I mean, David and I, him being a Democrat and me being a Republican, is something that I think establishes a bit of credibility to the fact that we don't want this to be a political issue. Veterans' issues are not political issues. They're just issues about right and wrong, and we want to do the right thing.
Representative Tom Barrett is chairman of the State House Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs. We're talking about his work in the formation of a new nonprofit, the Michigan Veterans Institute. I know that you were deeply troubled by the audit of the Grand Rapids Home for Veterans. What's the latest about operations there, and what's your advice to the families of veterans who live there?
Yeah, and, you know, I have committed, certainly, and David has as well, and several others that serve on committees in the House and Senate have said, we are going to get to the bottom of this and we're going to improve things. At the home, they have changed leadership, which I'm encouraged by. I think that is an acknowledgement that the status quo is unacceptable. They have new leaders in the home itself, as well as at the Michigan Veteran Affairs Agency has a new director. I'm hopeful that these folks will put in place the policies that need to be done to correct the situation there. But I'm also intent on holding the contractor accountable. When the home was understaffed 81% of the time, that shows that there's some issues, certainly severe issues, with the contractor failing to meet their contract obligations. We are looking at some legislative changes, some of which would put in place inspection authority for the Department of Health and Human Services to inspect the home, similar to how they inspect private nursing homes, so that the state home for veterans would fall under the same parameters as any other private nursing facility would. And then we're also looking at setting up an independent ombudsman position that would report outside of the chain of command of the home there in Grand Rapids that could take complaints from residents and then bring them either directly to the legislature or to either the Department of Health and Human Services or Licensing and Regulatory Affairs to have them investigated promptly the way that other nursing home issues are investigated. In addition, we're looking at the way that funding is done for the department so that when the legislature appropriates money to fix a problem, that we know with certainty it will go toward that particular purpose. And then what I've looked at, too, is drafting legislation that really firms up our contracts in the state that would put in boilerplate language that says if a contractor is noncompliant, especially to the extent as to what happened in Grand Rapids with the J2S contractor, that the state would have a way of recourse to either remedy the contract or terminate with that particular contractor. We've seen with contracts with Aramark and now with J2S and others that the state wasn't getting enough traction to enforce the provisions within the contract.
A side issue I'd like to ask you about, having served at Guantanamo Bay, what is your thinking regarding President Obama's recent action to finalize the closure of Gitmo?
I served in Guantanamo Bay over 10 years ago now, so it was still a fairly new facility when I served there, and they've released quite a few of the detainees. What troubles me is that many of them have been recaptured on the battlefield, either captured or killed on the battlefield, working to recruit other terrorists, working for ISIS now, or moving on to the next rung of the terrorist ladder. That's deeply concerning to me, and I think we need to have a place where we keep detainees that we've captured on the battlefield to where we know with certainty that they're not going to be a threat to society anymore. There is no conceivable way that a detainee could escape from Guantanamo Bay because even if they were successful in that, they'd still be on an island, unwilling or unable to escape from there. You know, I think if we move these terrorists back home, that there's a significant threat that they could try and, you know, integrate or escape rather and then come come into a community in the United States, or that would leave a community vulnerable for attack for another terrorist organization, perhaps. Really, the bottom line is these are bad people, and we need to treat them certainly in a way that acknowledges the danger that they present to society.
We've been talking with Potterville Republican Tom Barrett about the new nonprofit he's forming with Senate Democrat David Kinesic, the Michigan Veterans Institute. Representative Barrett, thank you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl. This is a very busy time for those of you who follow basketball, and we've got with us Al Martin, the host of Current Sports here on WKAR, who really follows basketball. The high schools we've talked a little bit about off mic, Al. The high schools, the girls' tournament started last week. The boys' tournament starts this week. We had the women's basketball Big Ten tournament this weekend, and the men's Big Ten tournament is next weekend. So we've got a lot of hoops to talk about.
Okay, you know, I thought I didn't have a life before this month. I really don't have a life now, Scott. But I love it. It's March Madness, baby. How can you not love hoops?
You do have a life. It's basketball.
It's basketball.
Don't think about anything else for the next month. Okay?
I dream, eat, and live it, okay? I love it.
Well, we're going to share that for a few minutes with our listeners. Let's start with the men who wrapped up their regular season on senior day, fairly easy, comfortable win against Ohio State. Your reflection on senior day?
Well, it was just an emotional day, Scott. You know, what I find particularly cool about how Tom Izzo runs his senior day is that, you know, there's and when you look at it across the board in the nation, a lot of programs, what you come to find, is that they will hold their senior day ceremony before tip-off. You know, mm-hmm. we saw it with U of M over this past weekend as well as they fell to Iowa. But I think Izzo, you know, knowing the type of motivator that he is and diving into his mind, he loves to hold it after the game because it acts as motivation for whatever seniors are out there playing. And, of course,
they want to win that last game before the ceremony.
Exactly. You know, mom and pops are in the stands. The family's in the stands. Right. You want to put on a show and you want to close it out with a dub. So it was just a packed house, not only because it was senior day, but also Josh Jackson, a pretty heralded recruit, you know, arguably the number one recruit in all of the nation, sitting in the stands. He's making his decision whether or not he wants to join guys like Cassius Winston and Miles Bridges for the 2016 class. But he's also in the stands. But so that adds a little fervor to it. But, you know, before the game, Matt Costello's twin brother, he sings the national anthem. Costello's tearing up. And then, you know, Michigan State, this one really wasn't close at all, yeah. Scott. I mean, 91-76, the final of it. Denzel Valentine had a great game from top to bottom. Costello with his energy. What really surprised me, though, Bryn Forbes did not shoot well in this game.
Not by his standards.
Not
anyway.
By his standards, exactly. I mean, we saw him the other day throw up 11 three-pointers and set a Big Ten record, right? But he didn't shoot well, and particularly this Michigan State team, who has been lights out from the three-point line, they weren't really stomping on the throat of Ohio State from the three-point line's perspective. What's really remarkable is they were able to beat Ohio State and do it rather dominantly starting in that first half without the use of the three-point line. And that's always been a criticism. Okay, if the three-point shot is not hitting, can this team still win? They did, coupled with the emotion. And Tom Izzo said that this is, from top to bottom, his most impressive senior class that he's ever had. And I think that speaks volumes as we now hit tourney time, Scott.
Well, with four seniors, lots of senior classes don't have four players for
exactly
starters.
Right, and then you have two right from here in Lansing, and right. Denzel Valentine and Bryn Forbes, they grew up with each other. I mean, they bleed certainly green because of the history they have with this area.
All right, so Denzel Valentine might very well today be named Big Ten Player of the Year. What kind of chance do you think he has at being National Player of the Year? Lots of the coverage I see have him maybe finishing second for National Player of the Year.
I think he's a shoo-in for Big Ten Player of the Year. Now, you can make the argument for Yogi Ferrell, looking what I believe that Yogi did more with less this season with Indiana. Indiana winning the Big Ten championship and really closing out the year strong. But Denzel Valentine, as the Player of the Year, from top to bottom as a player, he does so much for you. So I think he's a shoo-in for the Big Ten Player of the Year. For that National Player of the Year conversation, you hear one name that's above everybody right now, that being Buddy Hield from Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. Buddy Hield has been so good. And I think the only thing that's hurt Denzel Valentine. When it comes to the National Player of the Year conversation, Scott, is that Denzel Valentine missed three games due to injury. I think if Denzel Valentine did not miss those three games and we saw those consistent numbers throughout that stretch of basketball as well,
yeah.
I think Denzel, you could go tit for tat between Buddy and Zell. But Buddy Hill's been so good. His scoring numbers have been so glaring. We've seen him hit game winners. He's such an emotional leader. It's really hard to go against Buddy right now, but Denzel was certainly in that conversation. I think he'll finish second, though.
Seems kind of unfair.
I know, right? Doesn't it? Because from top to bottom, I think, yeah, you know, Denzel, I mean, he makes his teammates better. And that's the thing that you say about Denzel. Not only can he score, but he, when he's on the court, he makes every single player better. And he's a pretty good defensive player as well. Maybe, you can make this argument as well, maybe the best defensive player on this Michigan State basketball team.
All right, so after the Ohio State game, he guaranteed a national championship. And
yeah.
I think the last Spartan to do that was right when he did it.
Yeah, and you know, what's so crazy, Scott, and I told you this story before we hit the air.
Yeah.
I asked Denzel Valentine kind of the same question, whether or not, you know, this team can win a national championship. He's like, yeah, of course we can. We certainly can go all the way. Moments later, I guess the beat writers come in, and then I see that quote when I'm editing my story. Like, whoa, when did he say he guarantees a national championship? But the thing about Denzel is he's had such a heralded Michigan State men's basketball career. And looking at the talent of this squad, they can certainly beat anybody. I think if they win the Big Ten tourney this weekend, they are certainly a number one seed in the NCAA tourney. At worst, the two, if they fall early in the tourney this weekend. They have so much talent. And Denzel Valentine, being the leader that he is using this moment as a motivational tool for his team. So when I read it, the only thing I was shocked about is that he didn't say it when I asked him the question.
Right,
okay,
right,
that's the
right.
only – am I shocked that he said it? No, not at all. But I'm curious to get Izzo's thoughts on that guarantee during this morning's press conference at 11:30.
All right. We need to spend a few minutes on the women's team, too. They made a real strong run in the Big Ten tournament, made it all the way to the championship game where they lost to Maryland yesterday. Talk a little bit – let's talk about the Maryland game. What happened in that Maryland game? It was very close at halftime. What happened in the second half?
They were shell-shocked, I think, Scott, with Ariel Powers, who is their leader. She only had 8 points, didn't score until the third quarter. In the third quarter, she finished, 3 of 12 from the field. You know, and they were still up by two at halftime, which was amazing. Against Maryland, this is a team that has won back-to-back Big Ten tourney championships, back-to-back Big Ten regular season championships. So it was really shocking because Tori Jankowska really just kind of put the load on her back. But in that second half, turnovers, 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 Scott. They had 22 turnovers overall, really made the game hard to watch. You cannot beat Maryland if you constantly give them gimmies as the game rolls along. But, you know, this is a team that had a great weekend, though. They beat Purdue, Ohio State, and then they fall to Maryland 60-44. But at the end of the day, this still is a successful season. I think they will get a pretty good seeding, too, as we hit Selection Sunday.
Well, I was just going to ask you about how high a seed the women might get. Do you have a sense
if I had
for
to
that?
Put a number on it, I've been trying to, you know, really, you know, put my hand close to the fire right now to see what national pundits think of this team as far as seeding goes. And I haven't seen too many predictions as to where Michigan State will sit in the tourney. If I had to throw out a number, I would say something between 7 and 9, in my opinion. I think 7 at the highest. They had a great year, 24-8, 13-4, coming just short of competing with Maryland for that Big Ten title. This is a squad that, from top to bottom, can also go pretty far. But they got to stay focused. I think it's more so mental with this team, Scott.
How's their health? The
health is pretty good. Health is fine. I mean, you talk about players like Ariel Powers. She's had no serious injuries. And just looking at the core here, the core that really leads this team, Tori Jankowska, relatively healthy. Jasmine Hines, we know about her career that's been riddled with injuries. Mm-hmm. She has been able to stay healthy this entire year. No concussions or anything like that. Brandi Agee, healthy. We know about how she started her MSU career. Akiah Taylor, this team is healthy. And I think that is certainly a blessing around this time of the year, because you look across the board nationally, there are a lot of teams that are just simply beaten up.
In the tournament and healthy is about all you can ask for.
That's all you can ask for, right? That's it.
The men are also pretty healthy.
Yeah, exactly. No serious injuries there as well. So this overall, you know, for both of these squads, Scott, it is going to be very fun to watch how far they can go. And, of course, with a premier spotlight on the MSU men's basketball team, I mean, this is the time of the year where Izzo wants his team peaking. Right now, they are certainly peaking, Scott.
And unless they stumble on Friday in the Big Ten tournament, you're going down to Indy this weekend.
Yes, I will be down in exactly. I'll be heading down there Saturday. So let's hope, you know, that Michigan State does not fall to either Ohio State or Penn State. They play the winner of Ohio State, Penn State. Both the Nittany Lions and the Buckeyes will play on Thursday. So barring an upset on Friday, I will be down in Indy at Bankers Life Fieldhouse.
Al Martin is your host for Current State on WKAR Radio and Television. Thanks, Al. Good
hey,
to see you.
Anytime, Scott. Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, environmentalists are raising alarms about a permit that would allow crude oil through a pair of 98-year-old pipelines below the St. Clair River. The company that owns those pipelines says they don't have any plans to do so, but activists say it could set a dangerous precedent. We'll talk with attorney Liz Kirkwood from the group For Love of Water. Plus, remember what iambic pentameter is? We'll speak with the Great Lakes Commonwealth of Letters about their sonnet competition, which closes appropriately on the Ides of March. That and more coming up Tuesday on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. April Van Buren directed our show today. Thanks also to Kevin Lavery, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, and Drew Hill. We're a podcast. Get Current State delivered straight to your smartphone every morning. Just subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also connect with us on social media. We're at KAR Current State on Twitter and on Facebook at Current State from WKAR. I'm Scott Pohl in for Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.